loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the state of Louisiana is set to evict about 37,000 elderly and disabled people from nursing homes after the state legislature slashed the budget for Medicaid. Rolling back the Medicaid expansion implemented under the Obama administration has been a longtime goal of the Republican Party. Notices are being mailed out starting today, and this will literally kick the elderly out onto the street. Next, a group of senators has filed a discharge petition in an effort to reinstate net neutrality regulations. The move aims to force a vote that could lead to the reversal of the FCC's decision in December to repeal net neutrality. Then, Donald Trump's decision to pull out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is a major setback for Iranian leaders who put their reputations and political careers on the line to negotiate the deal. Has the president doomed any liberal or internationalist bent in Iran? And then former CIA officer, peace activist, and frequent guest on this show, Ray McGovern, as well as Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin, were arrested yesterday for allegedly disrupting the Senate Intelligence Committee's hearings on Gina Haspel's nomination to be the CIA director. They were protesting Haspel's past history as a high-level CIA officer who was integral to the agency's torture program. And finally, Pakistan's parliament has passed a law guaranteeing basic rights for transgender citizens and outlawing discrimination in employment, a move hailed by activists as historic for the conservative South Asian country. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the state of Louisiana. Louisiana is set to evict 37,000 elderly and disabled people from nursing homes after the state legislature slashed the budget for Medicaid. Rolling back the Medicaid expansion implemented under the Obama administration has been a longtime goal of the Republican Party. We're joined in studio by Leo Cuello. He's an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Leo, it's always great to have you.
Thanks for having me back, guys.
Leo, when we read this article yesterday, we couldn't believe that what we were reading was true. 37,000 elderly, ill, poor people are going to be just expelled from nursing homes. How did this come to pass?
Yeah, you know, this is that theme of we're going to push gigantic tax cuts and sort of not talk to people about the consequences of it. And then suddenly when the consequences come into focus, everybody realizes, oh, wow, this is a terrible idea. So, you know, they are proposing $1.4 billion in tax cuts. Right? That is a huge number in the context of the state of Louisiana. And so to make up for that, they have to do really, really dramatic things. In this case, things that are going to be amazingly harmful. And we can talk a little bit about the scope of this, because even the number 37,000 may mask the scope of it.
Okay, well, let's go right there then. I mean, because 37,000 seems huge. Again, just for our audience, these are disabled and elderly people who will be evicted. They have received eviction notices.
Eviction notices.
Today, or they were sent out today. Be evicted within a couple months, I think by July 1st, by the state of Louisiana. So it's bigger than this?
Well, so it's bigger in a few ways. First of all, you know, you hear 37,000 people losing healthcare coverage. You don't think about the fact that these are very specific 37,000 people. These are people who have met a level of care need assessment that is unusually high, right? These are people who have been found unable to safely live in their homes by themselves. So what we're talking about is 37,000 people who actually have really serious healthcare needs and actually depend on Medicaid to be able to stay in their housing, right? So it's they're losing healthcare, they're people who are really needy, they're losing their housing. And you have to remember that not all of the Medicaid cut is going towards this. There are other things that are getting cut in addition to these particular programs. So this is like a part of the Medicaid cut, which is a part of what is being cut to fill in the gap of the tax cut. So that it's gargantuan by that scope. The other way to think about it is what it means financially for the state of Louisiana. Just to give you some perspective on this, right? They're cutting about $550 million from Medicaid. Louisiana is a very poor state, and under the matching system, the way Medicaid works, for every dollar of state money they spend, they get federal dollars. So when they cut $550 million of state dollars, they actually lose $1.3 billion of federal funding that would have come in. So the total cut to the Medicaid program ends up being $1.8 billion, something like that. We're talking about a program that in its entirety is $12 billion. So this is something like 15% of the program and $1.3 billion of federal money that does not flow into the state of Louisiana. So just think about any state economy, any small southern state that's lower income, where $1.3 billion suddenly stops flowing into the economy, right? Huge economic impact. We've seen one study saying that that's 57,000 jobs for people in the state. And then, of course, think about the impact of plenty of just private paying individuals, right, who are in a nursing home where 60% of the people in that nursing home are being paid through this Medicaid program. When this Medicaid program goes away and that nursing home loses 60% of the population, what do you think happens to the other 40%, right? Their nursing home closes and suddenly they are now looking for new housing. So you are just talking about ripple effects that are enormous. And so just talking about 37,000 people even understates the problem, as huge as that number is already.
I'm looking at a piece on KATC.com. KATC is a television station in New Orleans. And although this is just anecdotal, I think that this is important because it's indicative of what people are facing right now. It says here, Dan Lewis Coleman is a nonverbal, heavily complex man who has been at a facility in Pineville for most of his life. If he happens to lose his Medicaid funding, his loved ones are concerned about what might happen to him. Quote, he has been here since 1965, 53 years. He has been there since he was 6 years old. So basically, this is the only home this man has ever known. Without the money from the state, Coleman would be forced to move out. To where? He's just going to go to the streets? Now, Governor John Bel Edwards has said that he's going to fight these cuts. He didn't say he's going to veto them, which is kind of mysterious to me, but he said he's going to fight them and try to find money elsewhere in the budget to make this work. And the reason he's even saying that is because what you said just now is correct, that these people are just going to be cast to the wind and they're not going to get help from any quarter.
Yeah. I mean, in some cases, your best case scenario is one of these individuals ends up living, you know, with some family member who is not capable of actually taking care of them with the specialized medical attention they need. That's why they were in a facility in the first place, right? So you're just basically saying they're going to live very unsafely. That's your best case scenario. Your worst case scenario, like you said, is they don't have anywhere to go, and soon later they're on their own. There are a lot of opportunities for the governor, the Senate, to get their acts together. There is an opportunity for CMS to say, you know what, we're not going to go along with this. And if they don't, then there will very possibly be legal action to try and block this. So there are a lot of hurdles that this has to get over first before it gets to the finish line. But this is scary, and it is this politics of we want to cut taxes because we like that idea, and we're just not going to talk about the consequences. And this is a perfect example of what we just had happen on the federal level, right? At the end of last year, President Trump ultimately passed a tax cut of about $1 trillion. What are they doing now? They're talking about, well, we've got $1 trillion bigger deficit, so we're going to have to make some cuts to fill that. Let's do some kind of cap in Medicaid that happens to cut $1 trillion over 10 years. And what is the downstream impact of that? It's exactly what you're seeing play out in Louisiana.
And there is downstream impact. What people aren't talking about in Louisiana, as Brian said a moment ago, if you're gonna take 60% of the residents of nursing homes and throw them out, these nursing homes can't stay open. They can't financially make it with only 40% of their residents. And so CNN says this could result in 25,000 healthcare workers being laid off and then going on the unemployment rolls.
Yeah, and then becoming eligible for Medicaid. I mean, some of them are probably already eligible because they
nice
make so little.
Cycle they have there.
And again, you know, when I'm looking at some of the numbers, Leo, as you mentioned, because we have this huge tax cut. I mean, it's $1.4 trillion, I think, is the total number, something like that. I'm not sure. And much of it for the already very, very, very rich. According to some of these studies, The national deficit has increased or will increase by 21% this year alone. I mean, these are staggering numbers. I mean, we don't actually know. We, the people, don't know what a trillion is because it's just too big. But this is a staggering number.
It's a huge number. And, right, the MO of in this case, Paul Ryan and the House Republicans is to basically pour kerosene all over the House. And then later, when it's up in flames, say, okay, now we need to, you know, cut things all over the place. So they have created the crisis, and they're going to use the hysteria about that crisis to then cut services that lower and middle income people depend on. So what you effectively have, right, is a transfer of wealth from lower income people to higher income people through a tax cut.
Yeah. And we're taking, actually, in this case, money from the elderly and the disabled amongst the very poor, and in order so that the already super rich, I was looking at CEO pay today that just came out.
Yeah.
Leslie Moonves.
Moonves,
the head of CBS, $61 million this year. I mean, this is the kind of thing that's going on in America.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's obviously hurting those individuals, but as you said, it's the whole state. Healthcare, there's nothing magical about healthcare. Imagine if, you know, in the pizza industry, $1.8 billion just flowed out of spending on pizza, right? You can just rationally understand pizza places are going to be closing all over the place, right? It's the same thing with hospitals and nursing homes and other types of medical providers. And that is particularly true in rural areas where their operating margins are much, much thinner. And at the same time, the people in that area are lower income, and so there is actually a higher dependence on Medicaid, right? So that recipe is a recipe for disaster in a state like Louisiana, and this is definitely going to hurt their healthcare infrastructure that everybody depends on.
Yeah, and these are areas that were basically voting for Donald Trump, I mean, in the main.
Yeah, that's right.
And hoping for change. Well, the change has come. But it's a terrible change. It's an awful change. It's a barbaric change, in fact. John, I think we're out of time.
We are. We were joined here in the studio by Leo Cuello. Leo's an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. A group of senators has filed a discharge petition in an effort to reinstate net neutrality regulations. The move aims to force a vote that could lead to the reversal of the FCC's decision in December to repeal net neutrality. We're joined from New York by Tim Carr. He's the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. Tim, good to have you.
Hi there.
Let's talk about a discharge petition and what it is. It's an unusual legislative tool. It rarely works, but, you know, with a Senate divided as closely as this one is, and net neutrality being the important issue that it is, with some immediacy behind it, this thing may work. What do you think?
Well, we're confident that we have the votes to get the what's called a resolution of disapproval through the Senate. And that is the first step under the Congressional Review Act of how you do this procedure. Now, what this does is actually, if you are given, or Congress is given, 60 legislative days to reverse any ruling that the agency makes, and it was less than 60 legislative days ago that the FCC repealed net neutrality protections. So we have a limited timeline to get this measure through Senate. So we had a number of Democrats and independents, all the Democrats and independents that are in the Senate, 49 of them, sign on to this petition to get this process started, and we expect one more vote at least from Senator Susan Collins of Maine. So that gets us to 50, and it only needs a simple majority to pass the Senate.
Yeah, that's right. And what happens is, sometimes these bills are bottled up in committee and they're easily killed there by whoever the chairman is. But a discharge petition, if it has the signatures of a simple majority of senators, forces it out of committee, whether the chairman likes it or not, and forces it to the floor of the Senate for a vote. That's why this is so important. So let's make an assumption here that this does come to a vote. And I agree with you. I think you're right that there is enough support for this to make it happen. But then it has to go over to the House of Representatives. And what do you envision there?
So, yes, and we're fairly confident the vote in the Senate will likely happen by the middle of next week. And then it does move over to the House, which has a little bit more of a timeline for coming to the floor. And at the moment, we have more than 160 representatives in the House who've signed on to a similar petition there. And of course, you need to get to a majority well over 200. So there's going to be a very concerted effort on the part of my organization, Free Press, and a lot of the groups that we work with across the board, groups like Move On, Color of Change, Demand Progress, to get people to call their representatives in the House and encourage them to support the resolution there. Now, that's only, those are the, if it were to pass the House, which is a higher hill to climb than the Senate, it would then have to go to the White House where President Trump would also need to sign off on the resolution of disapproval.
Yeah, and that's really where the big question mark is. Since Ajit Pai, the FCC chairman, has taken this decision to end net neutrality, have you seen changes? Are we still too early in the process to actually see changes from this decision?
Well, the decision was made on December 14th, but there is a process whereby new rules get reviewed by government so that the rules actually haven't taken effect yet. That is to say that the repeal of net neutrality protections, the rules that prevented ISPs from blocking or throttling online content, have yet to be lifted. The date we just learned this week for that was set for June 11th. So the net neutrality protections that we won in 2015, this was under the Obama administration, under a different FCC chairman, are still in place. But we have until June 11th to restore them in some way, or they will be removed by the Trump FCC's vote last December.
Tim Carr is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker in studio with co-host John Kiriakou. Tim, your organization, Free Press, which people can go to freepress.net to learn about what you're doing. And of course, it's so important for people to become involved and not simply be passive spectators. I'm looking at your website, and I'd like to turn, if we can, in our last couple of minutes on another big subject. And you have, as your lead, tell the FCC to reject the dangerous Sprint-T-Mobile merger. Why is it dangerous, and what would it mean for people?
Well, the Sprint and T-Mobile are the third and fourth largest wireless carriers in the United States. The first and second, as most people could probably guess, are Verizon and AT&T. So if we go from four competitive providers to three, we will undoubtedly see prices go up. But one of the things that's important about having Sprint and T-Mobile competing with one another is that they compete for the low end of the wireless carrier market. That is to say, if you are, as most people are, you have a wireless carrier, the cheaper prices you're going to find are via those two carriers. Sprint and T-Mobile also have a disproportionately high number of low-income customers. They're very popular also within communities of color. So if you were to take those two options away, you have the pressure that brings down prices so that people can afford them will be taken away as well. And so it's been very healthy for the wireless market to have these two competing with one another. And they've also done things like offered limitless data plans that have actually pressured Verizon and AT&T to do the same. So we do not need any further consolidation in the wireless carrier industry, because it will undoubtedly cause harm to consumers, and those harms will be in the form not only of higher prices, but the sort of options we have on data plans, limitless data plans, will likely go away as well.
I mean, it's an amazing phenomenon in America, and well, I guess globally, this whole trend and phenomena towards monopoly, which means concentration.
Yes.
It means less jobs. When I was looking at the T-Mobile Sprint press release, they said that the merger was to, quote, increase competition, which was like, what? You're merging, you're eliminating additional providers. It's all this concentration, but it's to increase competition. I mean, it's just a straight out propaganda effort. This is just a way for really, really, really powerful and rich corporations to basically dominate everything. And if there's less competition, which there obviously will, less competition means on its face, it must mean higher prices. And of course, loss of jobs.
Well, mergers like this bring out the most Orwellian language from the executives who are contemplating them, because mergers make a lot of money for a very small class of people. The executives and the major shareholders of these companies and the bankers who arrange these sorts of deals, you make tens of millions of dollars off of mergers. So it's in their interest to go out in front of cameras and talk about the synergies of their merger, how it will create new jobs, will lower prices, it will increase innovation. And all of these things have been proven time and again not to be true. We usually see, and it makes perfect sense, when you take a competitor out of the marketplace should therefore become less competitive. Of course, you can't get the executive of these companies to admit to that, but if you look at the history of mergers, you'll see that that's a fact. As is commonplace, that prices go up as well, and it ends up being consumers who pay more. And these mergers also saddled these companies with very large debts. And in order for them to pay off those debts, they raise their prices, and they don't invest in the types of innovations that they claim they're going to invest in when they first announce these deals.
Yeah, John, it seems to me when we're looking at these issues that this is in many ways fundamental to any basic or genuine concept of democracy. Does the free press mean, one, just not state-owned, and then it can be controlled by, or telecommunications can be controlled by, or all of these media platforms controlled by a handful of profit-driven corporations that are making their decisions not because they care about really actually what we see or read, they just really care about money. I mean, they're only in this for financial purposes.
And it points back to that revolving door that we see here in Washington, where people like Ajit Pai, who used to be the general counsel at, what was it, Verizon, I think it was, then finds himself as chairman of the FCC, where he can do damage to net neutrality. And then when he's all done with that, he goes back to be the general counsel at Verizon or some other major telecommunications company. It's the entire system is corrupt. It's bankrupt. And this is what we get in the way of policy because of it.
Yeah, see, and I've done a survey of the FCC commissioners that have served over the last 35 years, basically back until 1980, and 80% of them have left their public service at the FCC to go on to jobs working for or consulting for or acting as legal representation for the companies that they were at the FCC to regulate. So the revolving door analogy is very apt. And of course, that translates to these types of policies that allow for these types of mergers to proceed, that give massive giveaways, like taking away net neutrality protections to very powerful companies.
Okay, that's well stated. That's Tim Carr. John, people need to go to freepress.net to learn about what Tim's organization is doing and to get involved with it and to support it.
That's right. That was Tim Carr we were speaking to from New York. He's the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Donald Trump's decision to pull out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is a major setback for Iranian leaders who put their reputations and political careers on the line to negotiate the deal. Has the president doomed any liberal or internationalist bent in Iran? We're joined from Tehran by Mohammad Marandi, an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Mohammad, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mohammad, one of the things that we Americans really don't know and don't have access to is what Iranian leaders are saying about these latest actions. I scoured the American press and I could find literally nothing. Can you tell us about the mood in Tehran and what people are saying?
Well, I'm not surprised. That's how it usually is. Iran rarely has a voice. It's always a one-sided discussion when it comes to Iran. In Iran, people are understandably angry. Over the past 3 years, of course, the United States has been repeatedly violating the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement. Under Obama, they were violating it. And I don't know if your listeners know this, but as we speak, I mean, even before Trump left the agreement, if I wanted to send a single dollar abroad or receive a dollar from abroad or euro, it's impossible. The banking system is still not connected to the global banking sector, and that is because the United States is prohibiting and it's threatening banks, insurance companies, and major businesses from doing business with Iran. And that violates Articles 26 and 29 of the JCPOA. So even before this, the U.S. was violating it, and Obama was violating it. And now, of course, Trump has officially pulled out. I think what has happened is that, ironically, Trump has united Iranian politicians. Those who are opposed to the agreement are saying, "We told you so, and you can't trust the U.S. government." And those who were looking for a negotiated solution are saying, "Yes, but we tried, and at least we showed that they are untrustworthy." So they've come to an agreement on how to deal with the United States, and that is just simply stop negotiating.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's important, and I'm glad you raised, Mohammed, that the U.S. had been violating the agreement from before Trump. I mean, Obama expended political capital to change American policy. In other words, Obama, not because of a tender concern for Iranian people, but for geostrategic calculations. I believe that Obama was trying to really forcefully pivot towards Asia, which meant to diminish the Middle East as a center or an anchoring place for U.S. military engagement, which was bogging down, you know, frankly, bogging down the United States as an empire. He expended a lot of capital to make it happen. A lot of political capital. He met a lot of resistance from Israel, of course, from the Republican Party, from others. And yet the Obama administration didn't live up to the promise of it either. Why was that from your point of view?
Well, personally, I think it was because Obama wanted to have his cake and eat it too. He wanted an agreement, but he also wanted to continue undermining Iran. And I think that's just a general pattern when it comes to Iran and the United States. The United States has never abided by any of its agreements with Iran. When the Iranians were cooperating with the United States in Afghanistan after 9/11, immediately Iran was called the Axis of Evil. After the Iran-Iraq War, despite the fact that the Iranians suffered a lot because of the U.S. The U.S. supported Saddam Hussein. They gave him chemical weapons, the U.S. and the Europeans. They helped him use those chemical weapons. But after the war, the Iranians gave Conoco an oil field, and this was to send a message to the United States. And although the U.S. government knew about the negotiations for 4 years, as soon as there was an agreement, they blocked it. So whatever Iran has done over the last four decades to move towards some sort of rapprochement, the United States did the opposite of what I think it should have done for its own interests. In fact, I think that what Trump is now doing is that he is pushing Iran, Russia, and China closer to each other, because I don't have great confidence in the Europeans growing a spine anytime soon, despite the humiliations that they've suffered at the hands of Trump, like Macron, we saw, and the German chancellor, she too received nothing when she went to Washington. But the Russians and the Chinese are much more reliable partners for Iran. And since the doors to Europe will probably be closed because they are fearful of the U.S. government, and since the U.S. government has shut the doors themselves, Iran will be working with countries that leave their doors open. And this benefits China. I'm sure they're very happy to have more Iranian business, and it benefits Russia. This hurts U.S. interests more than anyone else.
I think Mohammed is also right. Nothing Iran does will satisfy the U.S. because even Obama, as he's pointing out, the goal ultimately is to sort of weaken Iran, and perhaps to, you know, still sort of with the idea that regime change will happen, that the U.S. can go back to the good old days when the Iranian government was, in fact, an extension of American power under the Shah, who the U.S., of course, put into power.
Right.
I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal from a couple days ago. Wall Street Journal, which is exceptionally hostile to workers and to unions, loves workers and loves strikes and loves unions as long as they're in Iran.
That's right.
And it's a big picture of what looks like an angry crowd of mostly young workers. And the headline is labor strikes and worker protests erupt across Iran. This is slavery, in quotes. Workers turn not only against employers, but also the government over inflation, unpaid wages, and failed promises of the nuclear deal. And then the first sentence, Mohammed, teachers went on strike in central Iran city of Yazd. Steel workers and hospital staff walked off the job in the southwest city of Avaz. Railway employees protested near Tabriz, and a bus drivers union in Tehran battled the private companies that control many city routes. Now, the Wall Street Journal never talks like this about American workers because they don't want them to strike. They obviously want these strikes, but just talk about whether this story is reflecting reality or whether this is kind of a propaganda endeavor.
Well, you know, the problem with the U.S. narrative on Iran is that it has always been paradoxical. On the one hand, Iran is a regime, of course, you know, the derogatory term regime. It is a regime. It's brutal. It's despised. The people hate it. There's no freedom. It's falling apart. It's collapsing. It's been collapsing for like almost 40 years now. And then at the same time, it's a growing menace. It's a threat to the world. I mean, how can something that's always collapsing and falling apart and that's so unpopular and it's so widely hated, how can it be so powerful and such a threat to the whole of humanity and a growing menace? You can't have your cake and eat it too. You know, and if it's such a brutal regime, then I'm sure they should be able to imprison and kill all these poor workers. It just, you know, there are so many inconsistencies. The only thing that's consistent about the U.S. narrative on Iran is that it's negative. So even if the negative elements are inconsistent with each other, they're still okay because since they're all negative, it's all right. But Iran is a normal country like other countries, like other normal countries. I don't know about these instances that you point out. I don't think they're all true, or at least I think they're probably caricatures of reality without really going into it. I don't know. I have to look into it. But in Iran, there are strikes. In Iran, there are workers who are angry about their wages. In Iran, there are all sorts of things happening. But it's sort of like me saying, or anyone saying, that, you know, there were protests in L.A. against Trump, and so the regime in the United States is about to collapse, or since on the East Coast and the West Coast they hate Trump, you know, the United States is going to be divided into three countries. That's, you know, a silly caricature of reality. That's for me, a lot of what I hear in the Western media sort of sounds as ridiculous as the ridiculous examples I just gave you.
Tell us in the last minute or so that we have, Mohammed, what we should expect to see happen to those Iranian leaders who sat at the negotiating table with the Americans and did put their reputations on the line.
Well, I'm sure it's not going to benefit President Rouhani because, you know, he turned out to have made a mistake. But I don't think the anger is really directed towards him. I mean, there may be anger directed towards him for economic reasons, which is natural in any country, and we do have economic problems. But I don't think the real anger because of the negotiations will be directed towards him. I think the anger is directed towards the United States. And although his critics, you know, will say that we told you so, and, you know, they're right, but I don't think it hurts Rouhani that much in this particular case, because He can say that I tried, and yes, we just showed that the United States is unreliable. So I think at the end of the day, what happens is that the real antagonist and the real loser is the United States. And Trump has demolished U.S. soft power.
Yeah, this is a serious setback, I think, for American foreign policy. And I apologize that I have to cut you off, but we're out of time.
We were joined from Tehran by Mohammad Marandi, an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Former CIA officer, peace activist, and frequent guest on this show, Ray McGovern, was arrested yesterday for allegedly disrupting the Senate Intelligence Committee's hearing on Gina Haspel's nomination to be CIA director. Ray was protesting Haspel's past history as a high-level CIA officer who was integral to the agency's torture program. We're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's an anti-war activist, an anti-torture activist, and a co-founder of Code Pink. Medea, it's always great to have you.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
Medea, this story is bigger than just Ray McGovern. Tell us what happened yesterday.
Well, there were quite a number of us. In fact, I would say about 24 of us who were there protesting the hearing of Gina Haspel. And before the hearing even started, it was clear the police wanted to get us out of there. They were already there in large numbers with their handcuffs. Normally in a hearing, we are allowed to hold up signs until the hearing begins and talk, because that's just the way it is. We were told by the officer, yes, you can do all of that before the gavel goes down and the hearing begins. Instead, a new officer came in, said he was in charge, and had us arrested for holding our signs and for saying don't reward tortures. So it was clear they just wanted to get us out of there and try to minimize any disruption during the confirmation hearing. There were three other people who managed to stay behind, and they did get up and interrupt. And then, of course, there was Ray, who was so brutally treated.
Yeah, Medea Benjamin is our guest. Medea, your audio isn't perfect right now, but that's because you're actually at the courthouse awaiting for Ray McGovern to get out, to come to arraignment at least. He's been in jail all day yesterday, most of yesterday, all night, last night, and all day today so far. Are there other people there supporting Ray?
Yes, there's a group of us supporting him, and we did call some people from the press to come. You know, the video of his brutal treatment has gone viral, and there is a tremendous amount of solidarity for this 78-year-old, extremely moral, principled man who was treated so brutally by the Capitol Police. And we have people from around the country who are saying, you know, what can I do? What can I do? Should I come to Washington? You know, people are really moved by this, whether or not they knew Ray, just to see the way that he was treated for such a brave thing that he did about speaking up in this hearing.
Tell us what the reaction was in the room at the time, Medea. You're right that this video has gone viral. It's focused on Ray, and I'm wondering, with so many people in that room, how did people react?
Well, I was in jail, so I can't really tell you, but I have seen lots of videos, and people in general were really, they were hanging on every word, because here he was, in a formal jacket, obviously an elderly man, and very articulate. And most of the people in that room, I think, were very sympathetic and wanted to hear him out. It would have been so easy to give him all of like 30 seconds and say, sir, if you don't come with us, you'll be arrested. And instead, you know, they dragged him out and threw him on the ground. So I think there's other video of some of the other protesters as well. And the reaction from the people in the room was very positive. There was one person who got up and say, what is love if we allow torture? It was the words of the sister Diana Ortiz, who was tortured as a nun working in Central America, and she was actually sitting in the back of the room. There was a woman also who got up and said, Bloody Jean, and she was, I think, quoting John Kiriakou at that point. And so there were you know, several disruptions, but none treated as brutally as Ray McGovern.
You know, we should say also about Ray that he is a 29-year CIA veteran. He was a member of the Senior Intelligence Service, which is the highest ranking cadre of intelligence officers that exists. He was the personal briefer of President George H.W. Bush. He was a briefer of President Ronald Reagan. This is a guy who really, truly knows what he's talking about. He's not some nut who came in off the street and decided to make trouble. Ray is a bona fide hero who knows the inner workings of the CIA and is uniquely qualified to talk about it.
The irony here, Medea, too, is that you have Ray McGovern, who's speaking out against torture. He's in jail right now, and, you know, in a very pretty bad way. He's in jail. John Kiriakou, who you mentioned, who's the co-host here, also in the CIA, exposing torture, went to prison for more than 2 years. And then the person you're protesting, Gina Haspel, was not just following orders. As you said, John, she was integral to the terrible, barbaric torture program that the CIA created, and yet she's being considered as one of the top leaders of the United States.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Go ahead, Medea.
Well, I was going to say exactly what Brian just said, but there is certainly something wrong with the picture when you see the seven of us each dragged out in a very different way, but mistreated, manhandled. And Ray, when at the end of the video clip that has gone around so much, said not only don't beat up an old man, but said these are the thugs who are involved in torture. And I think there is such a parallel between the way people were treated at the hearing yesterday and the kind of I'm just obeying orders attitude that represents Gina Haspel and that kind of thinking that I didn't do anything wrong if I was obeying orders. Of course, we know the Nuremberg principles and what that the international law says about that. But it is very scary. And I think at the confirmation hearings, this issue being brought up of what if Donald Trump told you to waterboard and Gina Haspel acting like that wouldn't happen. Well, why wouldn't that happen when Donald Trump is somebody who said we were waterboard and worse than that?
That's right.
So I am very concerned not only for the new CIA director, if indeed she is confirmed by a pretty spineless Congress, but also concerned about what is going to be the actions of this agency under her watch.
Medea, I have to ask you, you're very well connected on Capitol Hill. You're up there all the time. What are you hearing about Gina Haspel's nomination chances? Yesterday, Senator Joe Manchin, the Democrat, the very conservative Democrat from West Virginia, announced that he would vote in support of Gina Haspel. Rand Paul, the Libertarian Republican, said he would vote against. And today, John McCain said that he would vote against, although we don't really know if he's healthy enough to return to Washington to cast that vote. This is going to be a very, very close vote, it seems. What are you hearing about these undecideds or these Democrats who are running in states that Donald Trump won in 2016?
Well, unfortunately, John, what you feel when you're in the Capitol, that it's all about them. It's not about the issues. It's about their reelection and what they feel will gain them more votes. And so in conservative states and people like Joe Manchin, you know, making those decisions on very cold calculations that have nothing to do with what is right and what is wrong. And of course, that's what is wrong with our Congress and the way that it misrepresents the best interests of the American people. So I think we saw it in the case of Mike Pompeo. There was a tremendous mobilization to not confirm him. And there was a lot of hope when we got one by one the Democrats to agree not to vote for him. And there was also the same kind of mobilization, and there still is around Gina Haspel. But I think there is a pall right now over this people working around in progressive movements around government, because it comes just on the heels of Donald Trump pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, which is extremely depressing. It comes on the heels of increased conflict going on in the Middle East. And on the heels of now this talk in with Korea, where Donald Trump wants to be credited for being a peacemaker when it was really the people of South Korea that have done this. And you add the Gina Haspel issue to it, and it just feels like our government is descending into a state where this one man, Donald Trump, is ruling in a fashion that is bringing us into a potential catastrophe, and Gina Haspel is just one piece of that.
Yeah, John, Trump didn't have to nominate Gina Haspel. He wanted to. I mean, there's lots of other people he could have nominated.
Lots and lots of
other
people.
She's so associated with torture and the destruction of the videotapes that showed the criminal character of the torturers, a deliberate destruction of videotapes, not a mistake. So this was a very, very conscious act on the part of Donald Trump.
I get this question all the time in interviews. Isn't it true they say that Gina Haspel is highly qualified? She's walked the walk. She's had leadership positions throughout the agency. And I say, yeah, all of that is true. It's also irrelevant. First of all, there are 50 women in the senior intelligence service around the intelligence community who are equally qualified for that job. It's great that the president wants to name a woman. It shouldn't be Gina Haspel, because her actions during the torture regime ought to be disqualifying. She could have said no, but she didn't say no. She said yes, sir, when told to destroy the tapes. She said yes, sir, when told to go out to the secret site and manage the torture program there. That in and of itself ought to disqualify her for this job. I hate to say it, but we're out of time again. We were joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's an anti-war and anti-torture activist, and she's also the co-founder of Code Pink. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Pakistan's parliament has passed a law guaranteeing basic rights for transgender citizens and outlawing discrimination in employment, a move hailed by activists as historic for the conservative South Asian country. We're going to talk about it today here in the studio with transgender activist Morgan Artakina. Morgan, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Morgan, I lived in Pakistan. I served in Pakistan. I said off the air only half jokingly, this is a country that still sets people on fire when they think that they've blasphemed against the Prophet Muhammad. How is it that the Pakistani parliament passed something that was so progressive and so enlightened in such a conservative society?
I think that in many ways, like, the Western image of Pakistan is kind of distorted and caricatured according to kind of the way that, you know, the image that part of the world is that they want to project, the media does, and kind of and people. And so, I mean, of course, you know, there's conservative elements, religious elements, violent elements and stuff that, you know, get a lot of media attention for that. But I mean, there's also progressive forces, democratic forces, you know, feminist and secular forces too, you know, and same as any other society on earth, you know, but there's a lot of religious bigots and violence driven by that in the United States too. But I think what makes the difference, you know, it's not the some inherent part of the culture, something that makes it more or less likely for civil rights to, you know, become prominent. I think it's the strength of the struggle against bigotry and oppression by the oppressed and their allies that matters. And so, you know, this victory isn't just something that just kind of popped up out of the blue. It's that the end of a long and difficult fight by Pakistan's trans and Khawaja Sira communities to win these rights.
I have to say, I think that this is an enlightened move. Now, this measure passed the Pakistani Senate in March. Now it passed the lower house of parliament, and the president of Pakistan has 10 days to sign it. Do you have any indication what he's going to do? And can you tell us a little bit about the level of public support? I mean, there must be public support if enough parliamentarians were willing to cast a yes vote.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know what the Pakistani president is expected to do on this, but from what I've seen, people in Pakistan, the activists and such who are, you know, behind this, seem very optimistic about, you know, that now the worst hurdles have already been overcome. In parliament, the bill was championed by the Pakistan People's Party, which is kind of a broadly left nationalist social democratic party that's been very prominent in Pakistani politics since, I don't know, probably the 70s or 80s or so, very heavily associated with, like, the Bhutto family, from which many prime ministers have come. So that, you know, that was really championed in the National Assembly by them. But, you know, supporting them, there's all an alliance of LGBTQ advocacy groups, you know, NGOs and stuff, as well as social activist groups that have been, you know, fighting for this stuff and similar types of rights, protections from like domestic violence and things like that for a long time, too.
There's an article about this bill on SputnikNews.com that I think you authored.
I did.
And you make an important point here. Toward the bottom of the piece, you say, last year, Pakistan's ASCorp Entertainment joined the cultural struggle against transphobia, announcing that it was launching a new comic book, Basila and the Street Crew, that tells the story of a young orphan girl who was raised by a transgender woman. 10 years ago, I think we wouldn't have seen something like this in Pakistan. And comic books, and this is going to sound silly, but comic books are very, very important in the region in that everybody reads them, and you can really discuss important cultural issues in comic books. For example, there was a comic book that was the number one selling book of its kind in Iraq that had a very strongly anti-terrorism message, let's say. So on issues like this that are or can be culturally sensitive, really the best way to convey the information is in a comic book. And you're able to impact more people that way than you would, say, if you ran it as a political campaign or took out advertising or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, I know, like in the United States, for example, or I guess in any English speaking country, you know, like the X-Men, you know, kind of represented the same kind of thing back in the day, alternately standing in for the fight for racial justice, but also you know, for like for the gay and lesbian community too. You know, kind of turning these people who were on the you know, on downtrodden and persecuted into protagonists, and putting you in the position of, you know, wanting to defend them and take their side in their struggle.
Morgan, let's talk about the protections in this bill. I mean, they're really, really significant. In some ways, perhaps, and it's one of the ironies of history that some place that's noted for its social conservatism or conservatism based on older religious strictures and scriptures suddenly starts to like zoom forward and become, in a way, almost a vanguard. Let's talk about what's in the bill.
The bill is so impressive. It's something, it's just reading the, I'll give you a laundry list here in just a second. It's so impressive. It's so, like, just as an activist, it's so inspiring to see this stuff actually happening. Like, it's almost beyond the ability, almost beyond the ability of me to imagine. So some of the things that the bill provides, protections, makes it possible for trans people to obtain a driver's license and passport, makes it gives them the option to change one's gender in the national database and registration records, the prohibition of harassment at home and in public, protection from discrimination by educational institutions, employers, health and trade services, as well as on public transportation, in buying, selling, or renting property. Equal right to the inheritance of property, the right to vote in all elections for all levels of government, and equal right to pursue public office, separate rooms for detainment in jails, government-established safe houses that will provide medical and educational facilities and psychological counseling, as well as a government promise to ensure equal employment opportunities and a penalty of 50,000 rupees, which is about $432, will be issued to people who force trans people to beg.
Morgan, one of the points that you made earlier that I think is extremely important is that the struggle for trans rights or LGBTQ rights in a socially conservative place like Pakistan has a lot of similarities with the struggle here inside the United States, which is considered to be a sort of a place where there was the Renaissance and individual rights and the freedom of the individual has already been ensconced in culturally in all kind of ways. But let's just talk about how this law, this new phenomenal law, compares, say, to the rights that trans people have inside the United States.
Like I was saying earlier when you asked me about like how did this happen in Pakistan, these things come about as the result of struggle, of prolonged, you know, difficult struggle that people spend many decades to achieve. And so like in Pakistan, you know, a lot of the things that went into this law were initially recommendations by Pakistan Supreme Court over the last decade or so in a handful of individual cases, giving people the right to gender affirmation surgery or, you know, addressing this or that other issue. And so you can kind of see a direct line between these rulings in 2009, 2010 into, this law that was just passed last week. And in the U.S., it's been kind of the same way. I mean, obviously, it's different because the U.S. has, you know, 50 states and the District of Columbia. And so the fight for civil rights is one that is kind of differently patterned. You know, so we had, you know, building towards marriage equality, you know, in individual states and stuff. And then eventually the Supreme Court, you know, made its ruling or whatever. And there isn't really national level legislation that gives trans people any rights in the United States. The closest that we have is that under Obama, there was some key civil rights provisions that were reinterpreted as providing certain legal protections for trans and gender nonconforming people. One is Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits employers from discriminating against employees on the basis of sex, race, color, national origin, or religion. In 2016, the Supreme Court said that that also covers gender identity. In 2016, they also said that a follow-up law to that, which was Title IX, is what it's colloquially called, specifically protects equal access to education for those groups and protects students and staff from discrimination and harassment and stuff, that also covers trans people. And then since Trump has become president in the last year or so and change, his administration has walked back both of those protections. Jeff Sessions specifically said, you know, these don't cover trans identity anymore. Of course, the battle over the ban of trans people serving in the military is well known, too. You know, Trump said that trans people are a burden to the state. Trans healthcare is a burden to the state and stuff. So they're without an equal rights amendment or any national level rights. You know, all those rights are subject to interpretation and reinterpretation. So it's so impressive that Pakistan has just put this into a national law.
John, I think we're about out of time, but you know what I think Morgan is saying, which is extremely important, and people who are not trans or not in the LGBTQ community might not realize it, is that the positive steps forward for trans rights are just add-ons to earlier civil rights legislation. But what the Pakistan bill seems to me to do is not just an add-on and say, you too are covered by this. These are affirmative actions that are being taken to support and uphold and help the trans community not just exist, but to start to thrive. That's an affirmative sort of orientation.
That's right, which is far, far more than most any other country in the world has done. It's a surprise it came from Pakistan, but we'll take what we can get. We were joined here in the studio by transgender activist Morgan Artakina. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can now follow us on Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.